Black magic. Matt Henry was a hermit who lived alone in a decrepit mansion at the edge of town. Rumors were rife about the wild-eyed man. Some folks said that he was a magician who called upon the powers of darkness to wreak havoc upon his neighbors. Others called him a mad doctor who could restore life to foul corpses from the local cemetery. No respectable citizen in town had anything to do with Matt Henry. Then one year a new family moved to town with a lovely daughter, Rachel, who caught Matt Henry's eye. He showered the maiden with gift goblets of pure gold, necklaces of pearl, and a pot of daisies that never dropped a single petal. Despite the gifts, Rachel fell in love with another, Jeffrey, a handsome young man just home from university. A week after meeting, they eloped, leaving behind a stunned Matt Henry. When Rachel and Jeffrey returned from the elopement, they threw a big ball and invited everyone in town. While Rachel was waltzing with her father, she heard a clap of thunder. Lightning flashed again and again. Suddenly, the double doors blew open and a breeze whirled in, bringing with it the smell of dead, decaying things. Matt Henry loomed in the doorway, pupils gleaming red with anger. He was followed by the grotesque figures of the dead, who came marching two by two into the room. Their eye sockets glowed with blue fire as they surrounded the room. Two of the corpses captured Jeffrey and threw him down at the feet of their lord. Red eyes gleaming, Matt Henry drew a silver-bladed knife and casually cut the bridegroom's throat from ear to ear. Rachel screamed and ran forward, pushing through the foul, stinking corpses of the dead, and flung herself upon her dying husband. "Kill us both," she cried desperately. But Matt Henry plucked the lass out of the pool of blood surrounding her dead husband and carried her out into the thundering night. Behind him, the army of the dead turned from the grisly scene and followed their master. The sounds of thunder and lightning faded away as the alchemist and his dead companions disappeared into the dark night. Jeffrey's father and Rachel's father gathered a small mob and followed the evil hermit, intent upon saving Rachel. When they searched Matt Henry's house, they found it completely empty save for a light, which shone from a series of mysterious globes that bobbed near the ceiling of each room. Matt Henry had vanished. Search parties scoured the countryside for days, but turned up nothing. Jeffrey was buried in the local cemetery, and the dance hall was torn down. No one in town spoke about what had happened, and no one dared imagine what had become of poor Rachel. A year to the day after the ball, a timid knock sounded upon the door of Rachel's parents' home. When her father opened it, he saw a gaunt, gray figure on the stoop. Her eyes were dull with exhaustion and pain. It was Rachel. Her tongue had been cut out so she couldn't speak. But when she produced a knife from her tattered garments, the knife with a silver blade that they had last seen in the hands of Matt Henry, the gleam of satisfaction in Rachel's eyes told them that the streaks of blood that coated the knife were those of Matt Henry. That night, Rachel died in her sleep with a peaceful smile upon her ravaged face. Raw head and bloody bones. Way back in the deep woods there lived a scrawny old woman who had a reputation for being the best conjuring woman in the Ozarks. With her bedraggled black and gray hair, funny eyes, one yellow and one green, and her crooked nose, old Betty was not a pretty picture, but she was the best there was at fixing what ailed a man, and that was all that counted. Old Betty's house was full of herbs and roots and bottles filled with conjuring medicine. The walls were lined with strange books brimming with magical spells. Old Betty was the only one living in the hollow who knew how to read. Her granny, who was also a conjurer, had taught her the skill as part of her magical training. Just about the only friend old Betty had was a tough, mean, ugly old razorback hog that ran wild around her place. It rooted so much in her kitchen garbage that all the leftover spells started affecting it. Some folks swore up and down that the old razorback hog sometimes walked upright like man. One fellow claimed he'd seen the pig sitting in the rocker on old Betty's porch, chattering away to her while she stewed up some potions in the kitchen, but everyone discounted that story on account of the fellow who told it was a little too fond of moonshine. Rawhead was the name old Betty gave the razorback, referring maybe to the way the ugly creature looked a bit like some of the dead pigs come butchering time down in Hogskull Hollow. The Razorback didn't mind the funny name. Rawhead kept following old Betty around her little cabin and rooting up the kitchen leftovers. He even walked to town with her when she came to the local mercantile to sell her home remedies. Well, folks in town got so used to seeing Rawhead and old Betty around the town that it looked mighty strange one day around hog driving time when old Betty came to the mercantile without him. "Where's Rawhead?" the owner asked as he accepted her basket full of home remedy potions. The liquid in the bottle swished in an agitated manner as old Betty said, "I ain't seen him around today, and I'm mighty worried." "You seen him here in town?" "Nobody's seen him around today." "They would have told me if they did," the mercantile owner said. "We'll keep a lookout for you." "That's mighty kind of you. If you see him, tell him to come home straight away," old Betty said. The mercantile owner nodded agreement as he handed over her weekly pay. Old Betty fussed to herself all the way home. It wasn't like Rawhead to disappear, especially not the day they went to town. The man at the mercantile always saved the best scraps for the mean old Razorback, and Rawhead never missed a visit. When the old conjuring woman got home, she mixed up a potion and poured it onto a flat plate. "Where's that old hog got to?" she asked the liquid. It clouded over, and then a series of pictures formed. First, old Betty saw the good-for-nothing hunter that lived on the next ridge sneaking around the forest, rounding up Razorback hogs that didn't belong to him. One of the hogs was Rawhead. Then she saw him taking the hogs down to Hogskull Hollow, where folks from the next town were slaughtering their Razorbacks. Then she saw her hog, Rawhead, slaughtered with the rest of the pigs and hung up for gutting. The final picture in the liquid was the pile of bloody bones that had once been her hog and his scraped clean head lying with the other hog's heads in a pile. Old Betty was infuriated by the death of her only friend. It was murder to her, plain and simple. Everyone in three counties knew that Rawhead was her friend, and that lazy, hog-stealing, good-for-nothing hunter on the ridge was going to pay for slaughtering him. Now old Betty tried to practice white conjuring most of the time, but she knew the dark secrets too. She pulled out an old, secret book her granny had given her and turned to the very last page. She lit several candles and put them around the plate containing the liquid picture of Rawhead and his bloody bones. Then she began to chant, "Rawhead and bloody bones. Rawhead and bloody bones." The light from the windows disappeared as if the sun had been snuffed out like a candle. Dark clouds billowed into the clearing where old Betty's cabin stood, and the howl of dark spirits could be heard in the wind that pummeled the treetops. "Rawhead and bloody bones. Rawhead and bloody bones." Betty continued the chant until a bolt of silver lightning left the plate and streaked out through the window, heading in the direction of Hogskull Hollow. When the silver light struck Rawhead's severed head, which was piled on the hunter's wagon with the other hog heads, it tumbled to the ground and rolled until it was touching the bloody bones that had once inhabited its body. As the hunter's wagon rumbled away toward the ridge where he lived, the enchanted Rawhead called out, "Bloody bones, get up and dance." Immediately, the bloody bones reassembled themselves into the skeleton of a Razorback hog walking upright, as Rawhead had often done when he was alone with old Betty. The head hopped on top of his skeleton and Rawhead went searching through the woods for weapons to use against the hunter. He borrowed the sharp teeth of a dying panther, the claws of a long dead bear, and the tail from a rotting raccoon and put them over his skinned head and bloody bones. Then Rawhead headed up the track toward the ridge, looking for the hunter who had slaughtered him. Rawhead slipped past the thief on the road and slid into the barn where the hunter kept his horse and wagon. Rawhead climbed up into the loft and waited for the hunter to come home. It was dusk when the hunter drove into the barn and unhitched his horse. The horse snorted in fear, sensing the presence of Rawhead in the loft. Wondering what was disturbing his usually calm horse, the hunter looked around and saw a large pair of eyes staring down at him from the darkness in the loft. The hunter frowned, thinking it was one of the local kids fooling around in his barn. "Lando Goshen, what have you got those big eyes for?" he snapped, thinking the kids were trying to scare him with some crazy mask. "To see your grave," Rawhead rumbled very softly. The hunter snorted irritably and put his horse into the stall. Very funny. Ah, ah, the hunter said. When he came out of the stall, he saw Rawhead had crept forward a bit further. Now his luminous yellow eyes and his bear's claws could clearly be seen. Lando Goshen, what have you got those big claws for? He snapped. You look ridiculous. To dig your grave. Rawhead intoned softly, his voice a deep rumble that raised the hairs on the back of the hunter's neck. He stirred uneasily, not sure how the crazy kid in his loft could have made such a scary sound. If it really was a crazy kid. Feeling a little spooked, he hurried to the door and let himself out of the barn. Rawhead slipped out of the loft and climbed down the side of the barn behind him. With nary a rustle to reveal his presence, Rawhead raced through the trees and up the path to a large, moonlit rock. He hid in the shadow of the huge stone so that the only thing showing were his gleaming yellow eyes, his bear claws, and his raccoon tail. When the hunter came level with the rock on the side of the path, he gave a startled yelp. Staring at Rawhead, he gasped, "You nearly knocked the heart right out of me, you crazy kid." Lando Goshen, what have you got that crazy tail for? To sweep your grave. Rawhead boomed, his enchanted voice echoing through the woods, getting louder and louder with each echo. The hunter took to his heels and ran for his cabin. He raced past the old well house, past the wood pile, over the rotting fence and into his yard. But Rawhead was faster. When the hunter reached his porch, Rawhead leapt from the shadows and loomed above him. The hunter stared in terror up at Rawhead's gleaming yellow eyes and the ugly razorback hawk's head, his bloody bone skeleton with its long bear claws, sweeping raccoon's tail and his gleaming sharp panther teeth. Lando Goshen, what have you got those big teeth for? He gasped desperately, stumbling backwards from the terrible figure before him. To eat you up, like you wanted to eat me. Rawhead roared, descending upon the good-for-nothing hunter. The murdering thief gave one long scream in the moonlight. Then there was silence and the sound of crunching. Nothing more was ever seen or heard of the lazy hunter who lived on the ridge. His horse also disappeared that night. But sometimes folks would see Rawhead roaming through the forest in the company of his friend Old Betty. And once a month, on the night of the full moon, Rawhead would ride the hunter's horse through town, wearing the old man's blue overalls over his bloody bones with a hole cut out for his raccoon tail. In his bloody, bear-clawed hands, he carried his raw, razorback hawk's head, lifting it high against the full moon for everyone to see. Bloody Mary returns. My stepmother was vile. I guess most kids think that when their father remarries. But in this case, it was true. She only married father because he was rich, and she hated children. There were three of us, me, Marie, my middle brother Richard, and my youngest brother Charles. We were the price my stepmother Gerda paid for being rich. And we were all that stood between her and inheriting father's money when he died. So she took steps against us. She sent my youngest brother Charles away to boarding school overseas. It had a good, scholarly reputation, but it also had the reputation for being a hard school that was full of bullies and strict discipline. Not a place where a delicate child like Charles, who had been sickly as a baby, would thrive. He was miserable there. Somehow, Greg contrived to keep him there for all but the summer holidays, and when he came home the first year he was pale and thin with dark circles under his eyes that looked like bruises. He cried, he actually cried. When father told him he had to go back to the school. But father didn't listen to him. Gerda thought it would be good for Charles to go there, and so Charles went. I did everything I could, encouraging letters and daily phone calls until Gerda said it was too expensive and restricted calls to 5 minutes once a month. I even got father to book me a ticket to Europe so I could visit Charles. Gerda was enraged when she found out. Her blue eyes went so cold it made chills run up my spine, and her pink mouth thinned into a bitter line that bade ill for me since I had dared to interfere. 2 days before my plane left for Europe, the school called and told us that Charles had climbed up to the tallest tower and flung himself off. He was dead. Father was shocked, of course, and Gerda was quietly triumphant. For a few months, Father paid more attention to Richard and myself than he had since our mother died. But Gerda was beautiful and had winning ways about her that soon drew my father's attention away. And now that one of her hated stepchildren was dead, she focused on another. Poor Richard was next. Richard was a sturdy chap who was about to enter high school, and he was really into sports. He would have thrived at the boarding school that had killed Charles. So Gerda sent him to an art school instead. He hated it, but Gerda had told Father he had talent, so there he went. You'd think my father would have learned his lesson with Charles. But Richard was a survivor, and he grimly practiced piano and violin when he would rather have played soccer and football. But Gerda was clever. She introduced Richard to a couple of high school boys who were everything Richard craved to be: rich, popular, on the football team, and into drugs. Gerda made sure Richard had a very large allowance and kept increasing it as Richard was drawn deeper and deeper under the influence. Until one day Richard overdosed and Gerda only had one stepchild left. Me. I was sure, that Gerda knew Richard was doing drugs in his room that day. She knew he was ill and possibly dying in there. If she found him even 10 minutes sooner, his life would have been saved. So said the doctor, and I believed him. But Father wouldn't believe me. He was angry whenever I said anything against Gerda, and told me to hold my tongue. Still, I knew I was next, and I was sure that Father would not live long after willing his fortune over to his wife. I decided that if Gerda got too bad, I would run away and live secretly with my aunt in New Jersey until I turned 18. From the moment Richard's body was found in his room, I forced myself to be a model child. My homework was done on time, I was polite to Gerda and all her friends, I went on all the family excursions with Gerda and Father, even the dangerous ones like shark fishing. You can be sure that I took care to be seasick indoors and stay away from the edge of the boat. Gerda was clever with her tricks. Everyone thought it was an accident the time we were out shopping and I fell onto the subway in front of an oncoming train. I managed to roll out of the way on time, but it was way too close for comfort. I had almost decided to run away when my father brought me the sad news that my aunt in New Jersey had died suddenly in her sleep, poisoned by person or persons unknown. I was appalled. How had Gerda known? But she had, I could tell from the smirk on her face. I went to my room that night and locked myself in to think. I could run away, but the money wouldn't last long. And I need to finish high school or my chances of getting a good job were nil. Besides, Gerda would still be out there somewhere. If she could hire someone to poison my only living relative, besides Father, she could hire someone to kill me, whether I was living at home or not. There was only one thing I could think of. And it was a terrible thing. A family secret passed down from my mother's side for many generations. It involved a witch named Bloody Mary, who had once tried to kill my many times great-grandmother and use the child's blood to make herself young and beautiful forever. The witch had been stopped by the child's father, my many times great-grandfather, in the nick of time, and the witch had cursed him as she burned at the stake. Cursed his mirror, and the mirrors of all the men who had condemned her to death at the stake, so that anyone saying her name in front of those mirrors would invoke her vengeful spirit. The story had gotten mixed up over the years, as it was passed down first in their village and then all over the country. These days, school kids everywhere scared themselves silly chanting Bloody Mary's name in front of darkened mirrors during sleepover parties, and nothing happened to them. So no one really believed in the curse. Of course, no one knew the real story of Bloody Mary. That was a deep secret handed down by the villagers of long ago. But I was a direct descendant, and I knew how to summon the witch. You had to use a mirror owned by someone in the direct bloodline of one of the original families that lived in Bloody Mary's village. and the witch's name must be spoken by candlelight a certain number of times in their native tongue. It was an evil thing to do, I knew, but it was the only way to save my life. It was either Gerda or me. If I didn't fight back, I was dead. So I took my hard-earned money and went out to a specialty store to buy hand-dipped beeswax candles. Black ones. I followed my mother's directions carefully, placing them at certain intervals around the living room so that they reflected in the huge mirror behind the couch. Then I lit each one, speaking the spell passed down in my mother's family. And I waited. Father was away on a business trip, and Gerda was out at a party with her latest boyfriend. She came home late and scolded me for staying up to study. Her voice was playful and light. I hated that voice. It made her sound like she was nice. But there was also a note of suspicion underlying her words, and she stared hard at the flickering black candles. Holding a seance, Little Marie, she asked, emphasizing the word little, knowing I hated when she called me that. I just like working by candlelight, I said mendaciously, turning a page in my textbook. Gerda frowned. You know, Little Marie, I think it's time we had a talk, she said, walking over to the mirror behind the couch and primping her hair. Yes, I said softly. We should. You killed my brothers. And my aunt. But I won't let you kill me. Gerda laughed. As if you stood a chance against me, she said, fluffing her long blonde hair up behind her shoulders. I spoke the name of Bloody Mary in the native tongue of my ancestors. Once. Twice. Three times. Inside the mirror, the image of Gerda burst into flames, and another face looked out. It was the malevolent face of a twisted old crone, ruined with age, and altogether evil. I ducked behind the chair as Gerda gave a scream of sheer terror, her eyes fixed on the witch. As I watched from my hiding place, heat burst forth from the mirror, blistering her beautiful alabaster skin. I could hear the flames roaring as the witch laughed evilly and held out her arms toward my stepmother. Gerda, croon Bloody Mary. Come to me, Gerda. And she took my stepmother into her arms. Gerda's terrified scream was suddenly cut off. The flames disappeared as suddenly as they had come. When I peeked out from behind the couch, Gerda and Bloody Mary were gone. I called Father at his hotel the next morning to tell him that Gerda hadn't slept at home. Well, it was true. He wasn't pleased. He called a few of her friends from his hotel room and quickly discovered she had been carrying on with another man. With several, if the truth be known. Father hated infidelity. He flew home at once to confront Gerda, but she was still missing, presumed run away with one of her flames. Somehow, Father managed to divorce Gerda without ever trying to find her. And since she had no family in the area except us, everyone accepted the cover story, and no one ever tried to locate her. Gerda was gone for good. And Father and I were safe at last. The brick wall. Massey was a soldier unfortunate enough to cross me, his commanding officer. He did not live to regret it. There was something very satisfying in the moment when I thrust the tip of my sword into the soldier's heart during our duel. I watched him fall to the ground with the satisfaction of a job well done. The men under my command seemed depressed in the following weeks. They mentioned Massey frequently, but I ignore their conversations. One night, I retreat to my chambers to sulk and soon was joined by a delegation of men who were friends of Massey. I am surprised and delighted to learn that they had come to their senses and now saw the impertinent lieutenant for the cheat he really was. We share a round of drinks and laugh together. I'm afraid I drank far too much that evening. The other soldiers suggested we explore the lower dungeons. That sounded like a fine idea to me. We set off in merry spirits, drinking and singing and laughing, our voices echoing through the narrow passages. Deeper and deeper we went. My head started spinning and my legs felt like rubber after all that drinking. I am afraid I passed out from drunkenness, much to my shame. When I came to, I was lying on my back with my wrists and ankles shackled to the floor. Drunken men, fooling around, I thought. Very funny, lads, I called out. Now set me free. The soldiers didn't answer me. A moment passed and Massey's best friend appeared in the doorway, holding mortar and a mason's trowel. The other men began handing him bricks and I realized that the soldiers were bricking up the entrance to the cell in which I lay shackled. Very funny, I said again. No one answered me. They worked in silence, laying brick after brick until one row was done, then two. They were playing a nasty joke on me, of course. Then Massey's best friend paused in his work and looked directly into my eyes. At that moment I realized that this joke is no joke. Scream after scream ripped from my throat as I struggled against my bonds. But the dungeon was too deep within the fort and no one heard my screams. They were on the final row of bricks. I was reduced to bribery now, desperately using my wealth in an attempt to escape my fate. But no one listened to my bribes. I watched in heart-thudding horror as the last brick is put in place, as the last chink of light faded from my sight. I have been entombed alive in the deepest, darkest dungeon of the fort. I howled in panic, writhing against the iron manacles binding hands and feet and twisting my body. Eventually I fell back against the floor, my wrists and ankles wet with my own blood. My fingers were torn and throbbing from their intense scrabbling against the hard floor. I found myself weeping angrily, though I have never shed a tear in my lifetime. The agony of the thought sent me writhing again in spite of the horrible pain racking my wrists, ankles, and hands. Daylight. I must see daylight again. Just once more. Don't leave me here to die alone. Don't leave me. But I was alone, and the sheer brutal horror of it overwhelmed me. My eyes strained against the complete and utter darkness, and I wondered if they were even open. Dear God, I can't get out. I can't get out. I can't get out.